Ancient Egyptians had a complex society, stunningly ambitious architecture, and impressive techniques for embalming dead bodies thousands of years before modern chemistry existed. But despite their intellectual sophistication, they were not really interested in the human brain. In fact, they had a tool to pull it out, bit by gelatinous bit, through the nostrils of cadavers they intended to preserve, to be tossed away long before it could be sealed up for posterity within any pyramid. For Egyptians, the most revered organ was the human heart. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. The Egyptians' belief that the heart was the seat of the soul and all human emotion would influence countless other cultures over time, so that we still talk about feeling love or rage or envy or compassion in our hearts rather than our brains. But even when we think of hearts simply as organs keeping blood and oxygen flowing the way they should, in humans and many other animals, it's impossible to learn about them without being astonished at how brilliantly they work. Bill Shutt is a vertebrate zoologist and author. He recently retired from his post as professor of biology at LIU Post and is a research associate at the American Museum of Natural History. And he's just out with a book called Pump, A Natural History of the Heart. Bill, welcome to Think.
Chris, nice to be here.
I didn't even realize until I read this book that not all animals actually have hearts. So what conditions, broadly speaking, make a circulatory system necessary?
If you're really small or really flat, if you're a single-celled organism, then no matter what you are, if you're alive, you have certain requirements. You need oxygen. In producing energy, you produce carbon dioxide. You've got to get rid of that. You need nutrients. You've got to get rid of waste. So if you're a little guy, I mean really small, unicellular or very, very flat, then you can just get those and get rid of and obtain those substances by something called diffusion, where it just moves in and out of your body along a concentration gradient. There's a higher amount of oxygen outside, so it diffuses through your cell membrane and moves in. Carbon dioxide and waste move the opposite direction. But when you're larger, that diffusion doesn't really work. So if you're a creature that has hundreds and hundreds of cells or thousands of and millions of cells, then there had to be another method to evolve to get that material moved around the inside of your body. And so that's where circulatory systems came from. And so the heart is, there are all sorts of different types of things that you might call a heart. You know, a cardiac surgeon might not call the structures found in an earthworm a heart. But for my purposes, it's a muscular structure that pumps this fluid, whether it's blood or if you're an insect, hemolymph, around the body to transport these really important substances. So there's all sorts of variation, as you mentioned, in the animal kingdom.
This is probably a good time to talk about your insistence that it does not make sense to teach about biological systems separately. You always want your students to understand how organs interact and how they're kind of useless without one another. So if the respiratory system is compromised, we have problems with the circulatory system and vice versa. Is that right?
Absolutely. You know, unfortunately, I taught this class, this isn't unfortunate, but I taught anatomy and physiology, human anatomy and physiology for over 20 years. And there are these wonderful textbooks for those courses. The problem is that they're set up in chapters and students have this mindset where you can come in, learn the material, take an exam, and then sort of forget it by the time you go out to your car that day. But that's just not the way the body works and it's set up. And the way it's set up, as you mentioned, you can't really understand the circulatory system without the respiratory system, and you can't understand the circulatory system without knowing about the nervous system, because they are all really intimately tied together and very much dependent on one another.
What's the difference between an open circulatory system and a closed one?
Well, an open circulatory system is one that you would find in various forms in most of the animals that don't have backbones, the invertebrates. And here there's a pump that circulates this fluid around, whether it be blood or hemolymph if you're an insect. But instead of remaining in the circulatory system, in the vessels, at a certain point, that fluid leaves the vessels and enters into a chamber. And surrounding that chamber is the tissue that's going to be supplied By that blood or hemolymph. So that's an open circulatory system. In a closed circulatory system, which you find in some invertebrates like squid or even earthworms, the blood never leaves the vessels. It never, it moves through the heart, it moves out of the heart through these vessels, and it remains in those vessels until it comes back to the heart, and then the cycle takes place again. So that's the main difference between an open and closed circulatory system.
So humans have a closed system. It's not necessarily better or more efficient, but because it's the one we have had, science has been biased in its favor for a long time.
Oh, absolutely. Another thing that I try to stress in this book is that, we have this unfortunate habit of considering whatever it is that is human to be the ultimate, the peak, the pinnacle. And that's not necessarily the case, because even though you look at something like I mean, if you look at something like an insect, the heart of an insect, which cardiac surgeons might not consider to be a real heart because it doesn't have all of the criteria, it doesn't have the lining that they require to call something a heart. That's It still works extremely well at what it does, as do all sorts of other structures that are involved in pumping around this fluid. They've evolved for specific functions, and they carry those functions out very, very well. So it's really we're doing a sort of a disservice to ourselves, I guess, by considering that we somehow have this these superior structures. They're just different. They all work quite well.
You open the book with this story of a blue whale that had washed ashore in Newfoundland in 2014, whose heart was ultimately extracted for preservation. What made that such a lucky find from a scientific perspective? Not for the whale.
Unfortunately for the whale and eight of its friends, because nine blue whales died on the ice in Newfoundland in 2014. And my friends that work at the Royal Ontario Museum in Toronto, some of them are specialized in whales because they've got a number of species that are found up in that area. And so they've gotten questions for years and years, like, what's the largest heart in the world? Well, it's the blue whale heart. Well, how big is that heart? It's the size of a sedan. But in reality, they didn't know, because blue whales sink when they die. And this is why, in whaling parlance in the old days, the right whales were the whales that didn't sink when you threw a harpoon in them. Blue whales were, I guess you would call them, the wrong whales, because not only were they fast, they could swim up to 35 miles an hour, but when you killed them, they sank. So not a lot of was known about blue whales, and they did not have they didn't have a heart, so they really didn't know how big it would be. So they got the opportunity because these whales died, and three of them didn't sink. We think they got propped up on an ice floe, and they came ashore in three little remote towns. One of them was washed away pretty quickly by a storm, but the other two were recovered. And so by recovery, I mean heavy equipment, a large team of folks going up there, extremely messy, extremely stinky, and a lot of construction equipment. Four people inside this whale, severing the heart, pushing it out through the ribs that they'd spread. And when they saw the whale heart, and when I saw pictures of it, it didn't look like a typical mammalian heart, like you might see if you went to a butcher and ordered a beef heart or something like that. To me, it reminded me of like a 383-pound soup dumpling. It collapsed in sort of a blob, and so it was. They went through a major hassle to get this thing. First of all, returned to Toronto, then frozen for a while, then rinsed, then preserved in, when we were taking science classes, we were always worried about getting a little formaldehyde splashed on us. These guys were working with thousands of gallons of formaldehyde. And so the fear there was they'd fall into a vat of it. But the end result of their efforts was this incredible heart that was plastinated. They wound up sending it to Germany, and if you've ever seen the bodies exhibit, you see, that there's a that here's this guy is dribbling a basketball and he doesn't have skin. It's
Right.
that we've all seen those exhibitions. But this was the largest structure that they had ever plastinated. And they sent the thing back, and it was absolutely stunning. And so they realized that there was a lot that was surprising. One of the things is that it was a lot smaller than they thought it would be. And so they pondered those questions. Why is the largest creature that ever lived have a smaller heart, relatively speaking, than something like a hummingbird? And the answer they think is because a hummingbird, which is, minute size, their wings beat up to 80 times per second. And in order to do that, you've got to supply their wing muscles with blood. So how do you do that? You look at their heart rate, and their heart rate can go up to 1260 beats per minute. Now that's ridiculous when you think about it. 1260 beats per minute. And we think that that's probably about the upper limit that a structure like that, and you can think of the heart in some sense as a mechanical device, that's about the top that it can ever beat. So if you're going to get more blood to the heart, the only of the excuse me, if you're going to get more blood from the heart to the wing muscles, the only other way to do that is to have a larger heart. So a hummingbird heart is, relatively speaking, 8 times the size of a blue whale heart, whose heart beats maybe 12, 15 times per minute. And when it dives deeply, maybe 2 or 3 times per minute. And that deep dive is the explanation that they think for the fact that their heart collapses. It's like a to be like I said, soup dumpling. They are thinking of it in more scientific terms, that when there's this tremendous amount of pressure from a deep dive, instead of withstanding that pressure and having it stress out this heart-shaped structure like a human heart or a sheep heart, this thing just collapses because it's not required to pump that much blood in those conditions. So there were all sorts of interesting things that they learned from this heart, and they're still learning. There were arteries and veins that were coming off of it that still haven't been identified yet. And this is a mammal heart. We're supposed to know all these things. And luckily now we're able to do that. I just spoke to them yesterday at a conversation with the curators at the ROM, and they said that they've now recovered another heart, not a blue whale heart, that they'll be able to make these kind of comparisons now, which is always a great way to learn about anatomy, is to find an organism that's similar, and make comparisons. What's different? What's the same?
Bill, what is the difference between a neurogenic heart and a myogenic heart?
Well, we have a myogenic heart, which means that if and the way the example I give of this is, if you've seen pictures of or movies in which an Aztec priest is just ripped the heart out of some warrior at the top of a pyramid, and he's holding it up and showing the crowd, and it's beating. Now that beating is taking the heart is beating because the impulse that causes the heart to contract is coming from within the heart itself, and those are the pacemakers. So that little sort of neural signal spreads throughout the heart, and in the wake of that signal, that part of the heart contracts. So that is a myogenic heart. A neurogenic heart is something that is, so you're never going to see an Aztec priest holding up a horseshoe crab heart, because these hearts are stimulated to beat by ganglia, a condensation of nerves that attach to the heart, and so they're outside the heart, and when they send their signal, the heart then contracts. So that's found in many types of invertebrates, and I was interested in that. I was interested in finding a cool example of that, and that's why I started writing about horseshoe crabs, because they have this neurogenic heart, and then went off on this completely different story because of their blood and how it's used to detect endotoxin.
Yeah, let's talk about this. Their blood happens to be blue, but it was discovered at some point that it's got this really remarkable function. How is it harvested, and what is the cost to the horseshoe crab of being pulled into a lab for this purpose?
Yeah, that, well, first of all, it's blue because we have hemoglobin, which is an iron-based molecule, right? And when iron and oxygen come together, you get red. Just think of what happens when you get rust. It's not the same with the substance that carries oxygen in horseshoe crabs. This is copper-based. And so when copper and oxygen come together, if you look at the Statue of Liberty, it gets this, the oxidation causes this blue tint. But getting into the importance of horseshoe crab blood, in the 1960s, someone discovered that the blood of these creatures, which are really truly living fossils, that name, that you know, that term gets thrown around, but horseshoe crabs look like horseshoe crabs 500 million years ago. And to put that into perspective, that's 250 billion years before the first dinosaur. Horseshoe crabs were kind of clunking around. And so what he discovered was that there's the substance in a cell called an amebocyte found in the horseshoe crab's blood that when it comes into contact with endotoxin, causes a reaction that's a visible reaction. Now, let me explain. Endotoxin, I didn't know what endotoxins were. I thought maybe this is something that bacteria release. It's not. There are these types of bacteria called gram-negative bacteria, and built into their cell membrane is this substance that is, it's really structural. But when you sterilize something that has bacteria on it, and those bacterial cells are destroyed, then that substance that used to be a part of this of the bacterial cell membrane gets released, and if it gets into the human circulatory system, it causes serious problems. It can cause death. And so, as I said, in the 60s, a determination was made that by looking at this, by using this substance that you could obtain from horseshoe crab blood, you could detect endotoxin in a laboratory situation, in a pharmaceutical situation, looking at instruments, catheters, things like that. And so an industry built up around this. And so, I live on Long Island, and every summer, early summer, I'd see pickup trucks driving by with hundreds of horseshoe crabs in the back of the pickup. And I wondered what that was about. And what's taking place is they're being delivered to these companies that hang them upside down, stick cannulas into their hearts, drain their blood until it stops draining. Then, by law, they're required to put these animals back in the water. Now, unfortunately, they're not kept refrigerated, they're not kept in water, and they've just lost 40% of their blood. So many of them die. And now, I don't want to make it sound like they're not providing, that this substance doesn't provide in importance and save human lives, because it does. But now horseshoe crabs are really in trouble as far as their populations go, mainly because of this, what I've just described, and the fact that they are popular bait for eel fishermen and for whelk fishermen. But there's good news, and the good news is that for one, for as far as the bait fishermen go, Cornell University has come up with a substance that is, in a sense, a synthetic horseshoe crab smell. So, and then they're giving this stuff out to fishermen, and you could soak a roll of toilet paper in this material, put it in your trap, and it smells like a horseshoe crab. It's sort of, you could call it, I spoke to somebody the last night, and after I described this to them, they said, "I can't believe it's not horseshoe crab." And I said, "Oh, you should contact them. That'd be a great name for it." And the other thing is that there's DNA technology a couple of years ago that now has put together a test that can test for the presence of endotoxin without using horseshoe crab blood. And a couple of major pharmaceutical companies started to use this, and it was really gaining traction. And COVID came along, and there was this need for much more, sterilized, any type of procedure that involves sterilization of instruments, et cetera, in hospitals. They fell back on the tried and true methods, which were being produced by several different companies, and this new test went on the back burner. But the hope is that once COVID, once we get past COVID, that we'll be able to initiate the use of these tests that don't require horseshoe crab blood, because otherwise horseshoe crabs are in trouble.
I love reading any book that causes me to think about something I had never considered before. And in the case of your book, it is giraffe circulation. I hadn't really thought about this before, but of course their unusual physiology would create some problems for nature to solve. What does it take to pump blood through that long neck all the way to a giraffe's brain?
Well, first of all, if you're looking at an adult giraffe, the heart probably weighs in at about 22 pounds. It's about 2 feet in diameter. So it's a large structure. Now, if you're going to pump blood, and so their blood pressure is the highest out of any mammal. So we're, you know, whatever, 120 over 80. They're 280 over 180. So it's almost double the blood pressure. Now, if you're pumping blood at that high a pressure, if you're not careful, if it gets into a capillary bed, which is these really, really tiny, thin blood vessels, you're going to blow that capillary bed apart. And so they have these structures, especially right before their brain. So as this high-powered blood is making its way up against gravity and the pressure is still high, before it gets to the brain, it separates out into this capillary bed that causes the pressure to drop just enough that it doesn't explode those vessels. Hmm. And it's called a rete mirabile. Now, other problems are, would be, what about blood that is not only pumped at high pressure from the heart, but now picks up the force of gravity and is being delivered to their legs? And the way that they deal with it, so the idea behind the problem would be that if this blood gets into your extremities at a high pressure, that liquid would leave the circulatory system, and this is called edema, and cause swelling. And that happens in people with high blood pressure if they get swelling of their feet and ankles. But what, just like we've copied, what giraffes have is extremely tight skin around their legs. And so this is kind of like wearing pressure socks, and it prevents that high pressure from doing damage and causing edema, the accumulation of fluid in tissues where it's not supposed to be. And then they have all sorts of other adaptations as well. If they dip their head and they're drinking, how does blood return under low pressure from the veins back to the heart? And they have valves in their jugular veins that once the blood leaves the head, now you've got to envision head is down, they're drinking, it's headed back towards the heart, which is up higher. Once it gets past each of these valves, and there are 7 or 8 of them on each jugular vein, it can't back down into the head. Hmm. So they've got these, and other animals that are long-necked have this type of adaptation. But these are all the kinds of neat things that I ran into when I was, when I was writing a book that sought to look at the variation across the animal kingdom. And a lot of it had to do with, a lot of it tied into medicine, which was, to me, just a real bonus. People ask me, okay, so you're studying Burmese python hearts, but what does that have to do with my grandmother? And it has a lot to do with it when you look at some of these phenomena that take place in animals that we're trying to now apply these things to the field of medicine.
So let's talk about that. A Burmese python, relatively speaking, is not all that big, but it can eat like a big ungulate in a single meal and then not eat again for a year. What sort of circulatory magic does that require?
Well, the thing, what I studied there is the fact that when a Burmese python, and these are now invasive species, there may possibly be a million of these in the Everglades, and this all stemmed from the fact that people released their pets when they got too big, and now they've found this incredible place to live and they don't have any predators, and so the populations exploded, and then the wildlife from that area is really taking it on the chin, and so they're a real problem. So there are people who are studying this phenomenon that when they eat a meal, and like you said, they only have to eat maybe once or twice a year, their heart grows 40%. And so when we think of enlarged heart, we think this is a bad thing. But this is not This is not pathogenic heart growth like somebody would be experiencing, and where this is not good. You don't want that. This is healthy heart tissue growing, and so scientists are looking at what it is in their blood that enables their heart to grow in a healthy manner without really exercising. The idea being that there are certain people, if you want your heart to grow bigger and stronger, you exercise. But there are some people who are not going to be able to exercise for whatever reason. They've just gone through a procedure. Their heart is weakened, and they can't go through this through a normal exercise regime that you might prescribe to somebody who just who had a heart attack. And so, what is it about? What compounds are being are found in the blood of pythons that enable their hearts to grow without this type of exercise regime? And can you then apply that type of technology to humans and have their hearts grow healthily, without the required normally required exercise? So these are the types of things, there was this sort of laundry list of animals that I thought, wow, these are fascinating. And then looking at it more deeply, find out that, that there are medical applications for the biology that these creatures exhibit.
How does the human circulatory system behave differently from season to season so that you warn everybody that reads this book not to overexert themselves in very cold weather?
Yeah, well, the cold has a tendency to constrict the things that jut out, like your fingertips or your nose, and so those blood vessels are constricting and to send blood elsewhere. And the idea is that if you're in the cold, if your body's getting colder, you need to send that blood to the core to keep the blood supplied and you with it warm, because the blood is warm, and most of that warmth comes from muscle contraction. And when you're converting chemical energy, stored chemical energy, like from nutrients, into muscle contraction, some of that energy is lost. And that it's just like, and that's lost as heat. Just like when you're converting chemical energy and gasoline into the energy of motion that spins the wheels of your car, heat is lost. You can convince yourself of that by putting find someone you don't like and tell them to put. Keep your hand on the on this hood while I run the car for 2 hours and see what happens. But that's the idea here, is that there's this accommodation that the body makes to changing temperatures. And what I did in this book partially is I want to warn people that that there are times to go out and exercise, and by exercise I mean go shovel 2 tons of snow off your driveway if you live where I live, and times when you shouldn't. And if, certainly if you have heart problems, that's hire a kid or something like that, but just be really careful. But the other thing that people found most surprising is that you don't want to shovel snow after you've just eaten. And the idea here is that when you are, we have this autonomic nervous system that's in charge of things that we have no control over. It's like it speeds up your heart, it slows down the heart. One side of it increases heart rate, breathing rate, the other sort of slows it down. Blood pressure up, blood pressure down. And when you're eating a meal, right? And so let's say it's that morning, you just woke up, it's really snowy outside. So you look around, you go, I'm going to eat breakfast first. And so you pound down a bowl of Cheerios. And now you're, the parasympathetic division of your autonomic nervous system, sorry for the jargon here, kicks in and says, okay, digest the Cheerios. So without you knowing it, it sends blood to your digestive tract so that nutrients come out of the digestive tract and then into your circulatory system, then they head to the liver. Now, that being said, that blood has to is now is now detoured from going to other places. So, and one of those places is to supply the heart. And we have coronary arteries that carry blood from the heart to the muscle of the heart. And if you're cutting down the amount of blood that's going to the coronary arteries because your body's in a sort of relaxed mode, and it's digesting, sending blood to the digestive tract. If you go outside now and start to shovel snow, then you're going to put a real stress on the heart that might not be there if you hadn't eaten breakfast first. So these are the types of little tidbits that I never knew this stuff until I started teaching anatomy and physiology, but I'm not really interested in a whole lot of jargon. I'm interested in getting across information in a way that is, that is repeatable. And if you're sitting at dinner, you bring up something that you might have read, and that's what, those are the types of things that I'm excited about.
So there was a Syrian physician, Ibn al-Nafis, who understood how circulation worked in human bodies way back in the 13th century. How did he figure this out when nobody else had a clue at the time?
Yeah, well, he was able to work on cadavers and to trace the circulatory system in ways that the Europeans couldn't. One, because they weren't allowed to work on humans, and two, because in the West there was this sort of lockstep adherence to the teachings of Galen, who was a second century Roman physician. And Galen, the thing about Galen was that, like I said, he wasn't able to work on humans. He did a lot of his anatomical and physiology work on animals. So he got a lot wrong. But a lot of what he got wrong, he'd picked up from the ancient Greeks and before that, the ancient Egyptians. So unfortunately, Galen had written like 3 million words, and after the fall of Rome, his work was not translated into Latin, which was the sort of the language of scholarship in the West, and it sat around until the early medieval times. At that point, it was translated by Syrian Christians, and when they translated it, that translation that the Syrians did was ultimately translated in the West into Latin. So hopefully everyone's following this. But the story is that when the church in the West saw this, they saw that the translation had picked up this, it had picked up a Christian slant from the Syrian translators. And so they thought, well, Galen, that's great stuff. And so for the next 1500 years, Galen's work was, in a sense, determined to be and declared to be divinely inspired. So very little work got done in the field of medicine. Instead, you fell back lockstep with the teachings of Galen. Now, researchers, scientists that lived in other parts of the globe that were not sort of that didn't have to adhere to these principles, whether they were in China or in the Middle East, they went off and did their own studies that showed more accurately how, for example, the circulatory system and the heart worked. Unfortunately, it wasn't until the 17th century that the works of William Harvey, who was an Englishman, showed that how blood circulated around the body, that really that the heart was a double pump, with the right side receiving deoxygenated blood from the body and sending it to the lungs, where it picked up oxygen, came back to the left side, where it was pumped out to the body, and then returns to the right side again. So it's unfortunate that for 1500 years that was that wasn't the type of thing that people thought about. And it should serve as a warning to for scientists and everyone else to sort of think, don't fall into this sort of lockstep of line of reasoing that might be extremely harmful, and it certainly was.
These days, Bill, we don't think of stethoscopes as particularly high-tech tools, but they really revolutionized medicine. Will you tell us about that?
In 1816, there was a serious outbreak in Paris of what they were calling consumption. And they called it consumption because this disease seemed to consume the body from within. We know it now as tuberculosis, caused by a bacterium. And one of the ways to characterize tuberculosis is that you would there'd be a fluid accumulation in the lungs. And you could hear that if you pressed your ear to the chest of a patient. Now, back in those days, there were some problems with that. There were problems with sanitation, people not taking baths, you had people that had, that had parasites. And then you had the whole idea of here's this male physician putting his ear to the breast of a female patient. And so a young physician by the name of Laennec was walking around one day, and supposedly he saw two kids playing, and they were taking one of them took a stick and put it to his ear, and the other one banged on the tip of the stick, and he thought to himself, maybe there's something there. And what he came up with was a stethoscope. It was just a simple tube where you could put your ear to one side of it, place the other end on the chest of your patient, and then hear these heart sounds and lung sounds. First of all, started out with lung fluid, but then it became a way to sort of characterize a normal versus an abnormal heart, rather than just a normal versus abnormal lungs. So it became a very, very important a medical tool, and it still remains that today.
How likely are we to perfect technology to grow new hearts for people whose organs have failed?
Yeah, if you'd have asked me a year ago, before I took a trip up to Harvard and another trip to Worcester Polytech, I would have said, sounds like sci-fi to me. But so I visited this researcher by the name of Harold Ott at Harvard, and what he's doing is he realized that that thousands of people are dying every year, waiting on lists for transplants, and not just heart transplants, but liver transplants and kidney transplants. And the reasons for this have to do with, it has to be the right tissue type, the right blood type. You have to transport this thing. It has to be kept frozen. This is difficult stuff. So there are people who get squeezed and don't receive the transplant, and they wind up dying first. So what Ott
I've
envisions
got
is
about
that.
10 seconds to give you, by the way. I'm sorry to make you
Oh
sum this
no.
up.
Well, basically, he's taken cadaver hearts, stripping away all the cells, adding muscle cells from the recipient, and growing a heart from scratch, and then transplanting that into a patient. He thinks that's about 10 years away.
Bill Schutt is a vertebrate zoologist and author of the new book Pump: A Natural History of the Heart. Bill, this has been a pleasure. Thank you for spending this time with us.
Thank you very much for having me on your show.
You'll
Take
find
care.
the Think podcast wherever you get your podcast. Just search for KERA Think and subscribe and leave us a rating, or listen at our website, think.kera.org. You can follow the show on Twitter at KERA Think or follow me at Chris Boyd Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.